Okay, I think we should start. Boker Tov. I'm going to continue where we left off last week. We discussed the minhag to do Pirkei Avot in the summer, one perek a week, the original minhag from Pesach until Shavuot, and then we said they added a sixth perek because in the Mishnah there are only five chapters in Pirkei Avot and there's 6 weeks. And I'm sure many of you know in shuls they give every week a different. Different parak. The minhag was actually to say the whole parak. I don't know how many shuls actually they do that after mincha, where everybody would actually say the parak in Pirkei Avot. But for our learning, we're not gonna, I'm not gonna skip around the parak one this week, parak two this week. I'd like to continue going straight. So we'll continue at Mishnah Gimel, where we left off. If everybody has a Pirkei Avot in front of them, that's fine. It's not really necessary because I think most of the discussion will be sort of outside of the Mishnah, but it can't hurt to have. Okay, so the Mishnah begins, Antignosh Isocho, Kibel Mishimon Hatzadik. So we explain that Pirkei Avot is a listing of our Mesorah, the transmission of our tradition from one generation to another. So we're now around the third century before the Common Era. Antignosh Isocho. It's the only time he appears. It's a very interesting name, in many ways a strange name. And he was the link between Shimon HaTzadik. Shimon HaTzadik is the last of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. The Anshei Knesset HaGdolah are the ones we discussed last week who set Jewish life into motion as we know it today. Our Shmoneh Esrei, Kiddush, our prayers, they basically emanate from Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. They restored the glory of the Jewish people. That's why they're called Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the men of the Great Assembly. So Shimon HaTzadik is the last of the period of Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, and then we move into the period of Zugot, of the pairs, and the link between this as Antignos Isocho. So first of all, one notices, I guess, that Antignos is a Greek name. Obviously, Greek influence was very great in the centuries before the Common Era, after the Common Era, up to the Rambam, up to our days. Greek set up Western democracy. Much of the thought of the Western world emanated, began in Greece, and the Jews, of course, were greatly influenced. The story of Hanukkah is really very much how much of Greek culture Judaism should accept or not. That people wanted to reject it all, people want to integrate it, etc. So, and we know that throughout Jewish history, many rabbis had very non-Jewish names. You look in the Gemara, you had all kinds of weird names, Hermes, all kinds of Jewish names. I always get a kick of Rabbi Yishmael. I don't know how many parents would name a son Yishmael today, but one of the most famous rabbis, Rabbi Akiva's contemporary, the one he argued with the most, Rabbi Yishmael, the one we say every single morning in our tefillah, the Shloshes Remitot of Rabbi Yishmael Omer. I can't imagine a parent naming a kid Yishmael today, but it's a fascinating idea, and it makes a lot of sense. According to the rabbis, Yishmael did teshuva. That's what Rashi quotes when they come to the funeral of Abraham. So that's an interesting idea. But anyways, Antignos Isocho reflects the Greek influence on Judaism going on at this time. Ish, of course, means a man of great importance. The Meraglim Ish always represents importance. Socho is the name of his city where he came from. I don't know if it exists anywhere. I never heard in any archaeological digs. I never heard in any tours of Israel. They take you to the city of Socho, but all the commentators point out it was a city in the tribe of Yehuda. It means Antignos was, of course, the greatest of the scholars of this city. So he, except Kibel Mishimon HaTzadik, he got the tradition from Shimon HaTzadik. One should not be like, so Eved can be translated as a servant or a slave, and obviously the connotation is very different if you translate an Eved as a slave or a servant, where we were Avadim to Parah, we were slaves to Parah, but we're an Eved Hashem, we're servants to God. I mean, maybe that's not exactly accurate. Maybe we are slaves to God. I don't know. But it's an interesting how the word Eved. One should not be an Eved, al menat lekabel pras, for the idea of getting a reward. Ella have hey kavadim. One should be like a slave, a servant, Misham Shemit Harav, who services their master, Shalom al Minat Likabel Pres, not for the purpose of getting a reward, Bim Morish Shemaim Aleichem, and the fear of heaven should be upon you. We have to discuss what's the connection. Okay, so let's try to discuss what's he saying, that a person shouldn't do mitzvot because you're going to get a reward. Is he right? I don't mean is he right, but what's wrong with doing mitzvot because you want to get a reward? Free to speak. Okay, so there is a Gemara that says if a person gives tzedaka, it's a Gemara in Rosh Hashanah. The Gemara says, "So Omer, sela zu, this coin, a sela was a lot of money. If a person gave a sela for tzedaka, amenat sheyichya bni." God forbid his child is sick, and he gives an amount of charity that his child should live. So the Gemara says he's a tzaddik gamur. This is a completely righteous person. It seems to fly in the face of this teaching. The Gemara seems to say there's absolutely nothing wrong with doing mitzvot for the idea of getting a reward. So I'll start with a fascinating comment, actually. The Bar Tanura, we mentioned last week, that's the most important and commentary on the Mishnah, sort of the Rashi of the Mishnah, Rav Avadja Bar Tanura, living in the 15th century. So the Bar Tanura, 15th, 16th century, the Bar Tanura quotes where the Mishnah, a little bit later on in the Perek, says that Avtalion says, Chachamim Hizor B'divrechem, that the sages have to be very careful in what they say. You have to be careful what you say, how you say it. Shema tachovu chov chovat galut, because you can say something and it can lead to all kinds of terrible things. Here the Mishnah says it can lead to the exile of the Jewish people. You want to talk the way people talk, how you interact with other. When sages have a great responsibility, leaders of the generation have a great responsibility how they speak. So the Bar Tanura on that Mishnah says that that's a reference to Antignash Isocho. It's an amazing comment. Basically, he's very critical of him. Why is it a comment? He wasn't careful. What do you mean he wasn't careful? He said, well, you do mitzvot for not getting, don't do mitzvot to get a reward. And he explains that two of the famous students of Antignash Isocho were Tzaduk and Baitos. And I'm sure many of you know that Tzdukim and Baitusim. The Sadducees and their sort of compatriots, the Baitusim who rejected rabbinic authority, were students of Antignash Isocho. They said, what I gotta do all this stuff. I'll daven every day and keep Shabbos and keep kosher. I'm not gonna get a reward. I don't need this whole thing. And they rejected rabbinic Judaism. It sounds a little bit almost strange that based on that one statement, but that's what the Bar Tanura quotes. And he says that Mishnah's a critique. And that's not the way it's normally understood. We normally understood Antignash Isocho was saying something very, very nice. He's saying a wonderful thing. And the Bar Tanura was not clear. I was thinking about this last night. Is it that Antignash said something wrong? In other words, he said something in a way that it was very understood why people misunderstood him. He shouldn't have said it. It led to heresy. Or is actually, it wasn't his fault at all. What he said was 100% correct. It's just people misunderstood it. And sometimes even what's correct, you can't say. It's a subtle, but it's an important difference. In other words, is it that he said it in a way that led to misunderstanding and therefore that was wrong? Or no, he didn't say it in a way to lead to misunderstanding. What he said, but people misunderstood him or took it in the wrong way. It's not that he said it in the wrong way, but one has to be very careful. Even if you're saying what is the truth, you have to say it in a very, very careful way. So that's just an interesting idea. But let's discuss for a little bit the idea of doing mitzvot for the right motive. So many of the commentaries explain what's the connection between the first two parts of the Mishnah. In other words, you should do mitzvot not to get a reward, and you have the fear of heaven upon us. So they say to do mitzvot, not to get a reward, that's the mitzvah of ahavat Hashem. That's the mitzvah of loving God. And yem moreh shemayim aleichem is the mitzvah of fear. I just wrote my last piece on the Daf Yomi I sent out a couple of days ago. Yirat shemayim doesn't really mean fear of heaven. It means awe of heaven. Rav Soloveitchik said the word for fear is pachad. On Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we stand in fear. We're trembling. Our lives are unbalanced. But all year, we're supposed to have Yirat Hashem, not to be afraid, but to be in awe. That's a very different idea. But so you have the first half of the Mishnah says you have the mitzvah of Avat Hashem, and you love somebody, you do something not to get a reward. You do something because you want to do it, because you want to help the person. You care about the person. Who cares about a reward? That's not why you do it. But some people, that's not enough. The motivation of Avat Hashem isn't enough. So it says, Yeh Morah Shamayim Aleichem. You should have the, or awe, perhaps in this context, maybe it does mean a little bit fear. Fear of God upon us. And that's, so if we begin ideally with Avat Hashem, and if Avat Hashem doesn't work, so to speak, we go to Yirat Hashem. And it's interesting, the Ramban, I've often quoted in other Shiurim, the comment, we know there's a halakhic principle of asei doche lo tasei, that when a positive and a negative mitzvah come in conflict, and you can only do the positive mitzvah through the negative mitzvah. So what do you do? So the halakh is asei doche lo tasei. A mitzvah asei pushes aside the lo tasei. The classic example is, in the Gemara, the classic example is kilayim in tzitzis. If your tzitzit, your talit, is made of wool, and the wool strings and a linen garment, so you're not allowed to wear wool and linen. They're attached together. But the Gemara says, no, kilayim in tzitzis, that's because it's written in the Torah. The two mitzvot are written next to each other. Gidilim taselecha, make fringes, and lo tulbash beget shadnes. You can't wear clothes of wool and linen. So, but if they come together, the mitzvah asay pushes aside the mitzvah lo tasay. The mitzvah asay is more powerful. And that's, we think about it, it's kind of obvious. And the Ramban explained, because the mitzvah asay represents love of God. When we do something positive, it's because we care about the person. A mitzvah lo tasay, in a sense, represents fear or awe of God. And obviously, it's better to worship God out of love than out of fear. So the mitzvah asay, the ahavat Hashem, will push aside the lo tasei, the mitzvah of Yirat Hashem. Now, I'm hoping somebody would ask, so if you don't ask it, I'll ask it, is what about mitzvah haba aveira? One of the first, I think, very often, one of the first gemaras people learn is the third parak in Masechet, Sukkah, lulav hagazel, that a stolen lulav is no good, because I have a mitzvah to say, but in order to get that mitzvah to say, I stole the lulav. I took it without paying income tax, without paying, you know, GST. I don't know if there is like GST in Canada on the lulav. I forget already. But you have to, that's a stolen lulav. So the answer is also, I think, relatively obvious. It depends if we're talking about a mitzvah between man and man and man and God. God is happy for you to violate, so to speak, one of the mitzvot between man and God, if it will enable you to do another mitzvah between man and God. But I cannot violate a mitzvah between man and man to do a mitzvah between man and God. So it's a very powerful difference, because on the surface, asei doche lo tasei, a positive pushes aside a negative, seems to contradict this principle of mitzvah haba b'aveira. And the answer is, what's the aveira? Is it a quote-unquote an aveira between God? So God says, I want you to worship me out of love, not out of fear. But I can't, you can never, use man to worship God. You can never do something against man. We have a lot of examples in this halakha. Just, one famous one, how it applies today is very, not so simple how we would apply it today. But, the Mishnah, right at the beginning in Bracha, talks about workers. When you're saying people used to go to work early in the morning, they didn't have time to daven at home, and they went to work at the crack of dawn, so they would have to daven at work. We're talking in Israel. The Mishnah, assuming people are living in Israel, everybody's observant. So the Mishnah says you say Shema on the top of a tree. You don't go down. You don't. You can't go to Minyan. You can't take a break from work to go to Minyan and to take time. You're working for somebody else. So the Mishnah allowed certain things. In other words, the assumption is that a religious employer, it's understood, he has to give a few minutes off, but not too many minutes off. We didn't say the entire Berchat HaMazon. A worker was not allowed to say Berchat HaMazon. He had to be working. What's he being so observant? But so it's there. There's a huge difference between man and man and man and God. But that's the mitzvah. There's Avat Hashem, and we all understand that Avat Hashem is a greater mitzvah then Yirat Hashem. Now, so ideally you do mitzvot not to get a reward, and I think that is correct. Whatever the Bar Tanur, I don't would not really he wouldn't disagree with it. He said either Shmai Antignashi Soho formulated, he wasn't clear enough. That he's saying, yes, you do meet the ideal is to do mitzvot not to get a reward. Of course, there's a reward. It's all over in the Torah. That's why it's a little bit strange that his students wouldn't realize that. But all over the Torah, there are rewards everywhere. Baya im shamo, if you listen to the mitzvot. So, of course, there's nothing wrong, in a sense, with doing mitzvot for the sake of a reward. It's just not ideal. It doesn't express the love of God when you do mitzvot for the sake of getting a reward. Now, I'll discuss in this context, very related, the famous Gemara that Le'olam Yasok Adam Betor Mitzvot Shelo Lishma, Shemitok Shelo Lishma Balishma. That the rabbis say a person should always observe Le'olam forever. A person should observe Mitzvot Shelo Lishma, not for proper motivation. Let's say to get a reward. Let's say in our context, Shelo Lishma, Shemitok Shelo Lishma Balishma. Because the important thing is to do the right thing. And then from doing it shalolishma, for doing it for the wrong reason, you know, so to speak, you'll come to do it for the right reason. I'm not sure which year I gave where I spoke about that, you know, in the whole principle of the Sefer HaChinuch. The Sefer HaChinuch, I think, is like the, you know, in the top, one of the most important books written in Jewish history. Sefer HaChinuch was written in the Middle Ages and anonymously. We don't even know 100% sure who wrote it. We used to think it was Rav Aaron Halevi of Barcelona, a student of the Rashba. Now scholars are not so sure he wrote it. I'm not up on the latest who they think wrote it. It really doesn't matter. Sefer HaChinuch was written by a father to a son in Spain. And the son was becoming not religious. And the son said, Judaism, I want to study philosophy. That was a very popular in Spain. I think we all realize the Rambam, for example, you know, he represents that. All the Spanish, many of the Spanish people, they're very interested in philosophy. And philosophy is much greater than what you can get in the Torah. So the father wrote a book to his son. And he wrote a Rabbi J.J. Schefter commented once, because some kid was going off to Derech, we have one of the most important books in all of Jewish history. So the father writes a book to the son where he explains each of the 613 mitzvot. It's written in beautiful Hebrew, simple Hebrew, translated in English. He gives a one-paragraph summary what the mitzvah is, and then he explains the ta'amei ha-mitzvah, which normally translated as reasons. I don't know if reasons is the exact translation. What is the meaning? What message every mitzvah? And he wanted to show each mitzvah in the Torah what goal it has. But the overriding, one of the overarching themes of Sefer HaChinuch is what Nechama Leibowitz termed actions mold character. The Torah has so many mitzvot because the Torah knows what we do affects who we are, right? That's basically, in modern times, that's the theory of cognitive dissonance that I think some professor at Harvard got a Nobel Prize for this. I forget it. Leon Festinger, I think, from Harvard, I believe, won a Nobel Prize for this, the theory of cognitive dissonance, that basically the brain, it creates a tension when we think and we act in different ways, right? So we act a certain way, it will influence how we think. It's not how we think influences what we do. It's what we do influences how we act. It's a huge difference. It's a very important difference. And when you do something right, you become, it's not that people who are nice give charity. It's when you give charity, you become a nice person. Because if I give charity, I'm going to care about you. I'm going to care because why would I give, it makes no sense to give charity if I don't like you. So by giving charity, that's why the Torah says if I have two people to help and one of them is loading an animal and one of them is unloading an animal. So, you know, you should really help the person unloading the animal first because you'll help the animal at the same time. But if the person unloading the animal is your good friend and the person loading the animal is the person, you can't stand them. You hate his guts. So the Torah says you have to hate. You have to help the person you hate first, because that's the way to get rid of the hatred, right? If you do a favor to someone who doesn't like you, it takes them aback. So that's the major theme of the Sefer HaChinuch, that there's so many mitzvot in the Torah. Everything we do, another mitzvah, is to create good character. And the way to create good character is by forcing us to act. So that's the thesis, or that's really the theory. Who cares why you're motivated to a mitzvah? Do the mitzvah, do what's right. Lo'olam yasok adam mitor mitzvah shelo lishma. I don't care why you're doing it. And then eventually you'll come to do it for the right reason. So that's a very, that's a well-known thing. And again, maybe Antignor Shisoko is the ideal. We should worship God not with the intention of getting word, but it's not really realistic. And it's okay not to be realistic. Rav Chaim of Volozhin, I believe it's Rav Chaim of Volozhin, the founder of the great yeshiva in Volozhin, by the way, for Norman Lam, Rabbi Dr. Norman Lam, was, of course, the president of Yeshiva University when I was just there. Unfortunately, just lost his wife to COVID-19. Many of you may know Mindy Lam. So Dr. Lam's, you know, thesis was on Rav Chaim and Volozhin and Torah Lishma. That was his PhD thesis. You can get the book. It's been reprinted, a book in English. Rav Chaim and Volozhin, the top student of the Vilna Gaon. So he said that le'olam yasok adam, forever. In other words, it's impossible for a human being to always be purely motivated. Le'olam, a person will always have a little bit of insincere motivations or personal agendas. It's okay. We just want to move you along the angle. Le'olam yasok adam, forever. You're always going to do it means what? Not for the ideal reason, but the more you do it, the more you'll come closer to the reason. So that's, you know, Avat Hashem, if you want, Avat Hashem is also a hard mitzvah. But to do mitzvot, to be purely motivated is not easy, but it's a beautiful thing. I also, Rav Shechter used to quote very often when I was in his shir, the introduction of the Eglei Tel. The Eglei Tel was the Sokotrover Rebbe, Rav Avram Bornstein. He died, I believe, around 1910. He was one of the greatest Torah scholars in the Hasidic world. I don't have to tell you, many of the Hasidic Rebbeim, their specialty was not Torah learning, which is fine. That wasn't their role. They were spiritual leaders. They weren't halakhic authorities necessarily, but there were exceptions. The first, the Lubavitch Rebbe, of course, the Baal HaTanya wrote the Shulchan Aruch, and one of the greatest of the Hasidic masters was the Sokotrover Rebbe. He wrote the Tshuvat Avnei Nezer, and then he wrote a book on Hilchot Shabbos. It used to be very, very popular. I don't know how many people use it anymore, on the Lamed Tet Melachot Eglei Tel. And in his introduction to the Eglei Tel, he writes that some people think if you enjoy doing a mitzvah, it takes away from the lishma. In other words, you have to do a mitzvah because God said so, with no expression. That's the Yishayahu Leibowitz approach. God told you what to do. There should be no emotion involved. If I enjoy the mitzvah, then I'm not doing it because I love God. I'm doing it because I enjoy it. He said, that's a terrible mistake. And when you enjoy mitzvah, that's the higher level of lishma. The mitzvah should be so enjoyable and gives you simcha when you learn, when you help people, you know, when you give tzedakah to help people. So the fact that you enjoy mitzvot does not take away lishma. Obviously, there were people who disagreed with him. That's why he wrote it. And obviously, this coming from a Hasidic Rebbe, you would expect that. And I don't know, the Mishnagdish world, I'm not so sure. They said it in quite the same way. They defined lishma, Rav Chaim of Volozhin. He invented, so to speak, the invention of Lishma, or learning Torah Lishma. We always understood learning Torah Lishma means you learn Torah for the sake of doing mitzvot. L'mod al manat lasot, or to teach. He developed the concept of a Volozhin yeshiva. The way he approached was to learn Torah for the sake of learning Torah. Lishma didn't mean so you can do the mitzvot for the sake of learning Torah. But that's a whole beyond our what we are discussing here. So that's Avat Hashem, or doing mitzvot lishma. It's not exactly the same. It's a lifetime of work. There is one major exception to this rule, when it's very important the person acts lishma, and that's very hard. It's a little bit scary almost, is that when a person is a leader, when a person makes decisions that affect anybody, let's say our political leaders especially. Why is that so? Because the definition of leadership, of political leadership, if you're the prime minister of Canada, I don't know how many people here live in Canada, I'm in the US, but I live in Canada, so we use Canadian examples. You have to pass a budget. I mean, especially now with all you know, extra help going on. Who gets help and who, when you give more money to education, you have less money for healthcare. We didn't spend enough money for healthcare. That's obvious in the last 10 years to prepare for any unforeseen circumstance. We didn't prepare for the black swan event, because whatever you do, whenever you make a decision, you're going to hurt somebody. And by definition, in public life, you have to hurt people, not meaningfully, not on purpose, but you can't do everything. It's not, there's a little bit of a zero-sum game. I can't give money to everybody. So I take from here, if I give there, I have to take from there. So then it's very important you're doing it because you're properly motivated. That's okay. That's what it means to be a great leader, is to make a decision that is going to hurt people, but you think it's going to help more people than it hurts. But if you're a leader and you make a decision because it's good for your reelection hope, I it's even hard to talk like this because I don't, it would get rid of all of politics. But you make a decision not because it's for the best interest in society, but it's to help your own political agenda. It's to help your brother-in-law's business, pork bellies that they would throw into in Congress, all the legislation. So that's then you're hurting people without the proper motivation. So that's what the commentaries point out, that on an individual basis, yes, you should always do meets, but your motivation doesn't matter. But as you move into leadership and your decisions impact on others, motivation does matter. It's again, it's impossible to be 100% motivated, but it's much more important to be motivated. And that's why, of course, we say every Shabbos morning, even the Nusach HaTfilah is always so beautiful. I love Nusach HaTfilah. The way the Chazan puts the stress on that, when Be'emunah, whoever engages in the needs of the community in faith, Be'emunah, HaGadosh Baruch Hu Yishalem Scharam V'yasir Mayhem, right? So we ask God to help those who work for the community. We say every Shabbos morning, because the important thing is to work for the community Be'emunah. To do it because of faith in God, because you want to carry out what's done. So that's a little bit on the on this sort of notion. I'll get to the question a little bit later in a moment. I will add an unbelievable comment. The second most important, perhaps historically, although it's not studied so much anymore because it's too long. The Pinchas Kahati changed Mishnayot, right? I imagine many people in their house have a Kahati Mishnah. Pinchas Kahati, of course, was a banker in Israel. And when the banks were closed between 1 o'clock and 4 o'clock in the afternoon, when everybody in Israel used to take a break in the afternoon. So instead of going home, Pinchas Kahati would give a shiur on Mishnayot. He taught Mishnah to the people in the bank. And he was so good that he wrote up the commentary on the Mishnah. That became the classic commentary on the Mishnah. He died in the 1970s, Pinchas Kahati. But before the Kahati brings in all the important stuff from all the commentary. He gives you a nice introduction. He explains the legal concept. The classic commentaries, they never do that. They never give you background information. So that's in the modern world, we do that. So before the Kahati, after the Bartanura, the Tosfot Yontif was the second most important commentary in the Mishnah. The Tosfot Yontif is Rav Yoftov Lipman Heller. He was a rabbi in Prague. I've mentioned those who, we've had a number of Torah Motion trips to Central Europe and went to Prague. Prague has the most historically important shul in the history of the Jewish people. In other words, there's no shul in the world that had more great Torah scholars serve as its rabbis than the Altnai Shul in Prague. For those, it's not such, I don't know how many people have been to the shul. It's not fancy schmancy. It was built in the 13th century, I believe. The Maral of Prague, of course, and the Tosfot Yontif, and the Nodavi Yehuda, and the Kliyakar. The list of people who served in Prague, Prague was Irva Ein v'Yisrael. It was like the center, Prague, Krakow, these were some of the great cities, and they had the greatest rabbis in Jewish history, one after another, in Prague. So the Tosfot Yontif lived in the 16th century in Prague, wrote a long commentary on the Mishnah, often commenting on the Bartanura, and he has an amazing, he quotes, there's a slightly different, I don't want to call it a manuscript, a girsa, where it doesn't say, in other words, the way we read Shimon Antignos Isocho, it says one shouldn't serve their master in order to get a reward. Of course, there's a reward. In other words, that shouldn't be your main motivation. It can be your side motivation. You can have it in the back of your mind. That shouldn't be why you worship God. He quotes a version, you should worship God because you don't want to get a reward. He flips it on its side. In other words, I should worship God with the hope that I will not get a reward. That's why I worship. I don't want a reward. That's a very, most of the commentaries, they feel that's too much in a sense. But he prefers that idea. And he says that's what the Avot did. He says, in other words, a Jew should always be afraid that he's not where he is. I don't think this works for modern people in our modern generation. We have to sort of encourage people. Like in the Musar movement, Yisroel Salanter, who founded in the 19th century the Musar, when he founded the Musar movement. Musar means to improve, to be a better person. That's always important. But he mandated an official campaign to get people to improve. And the people he was dealing with were much like the same issue today. They were much more meticulous in their observance mitzvah between man and God than they are between man, because it's a lot easier. It's easy to keep kosher and Shabbos. It's hard not to talk lashon hara and to take revenge and not to cheat in business. Those are much harder than this. So he started the Musar movement in the 19th century. And the Musar movement had two basic schools, the school in Slobodka and in the Vorda. And the difference in Slobodka, that's where Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky comes from, where he learned in Slobodka, the idea of Musar, in Valashin, they were very anti-Musar, right? That was a whole big dispute. Again, this is terrible. What are we wasting our time studying ethical texts? We study Gemara. You get ethics from the Gemara. You don't need ethical texts. So that was one argument. But within the Musar movement, you had the school in Slobodka that said, man is great. Man is wonderful. We're creating the image of God. How can someone who's so great, you know, do what they're doing? We have to live up to our greatness. And in the Vardik, where the Aruch HaShulchan was from, the Aruch HaShulchan, the Vardik was, man, you're a nobody. You know, the old jokes. Who's he to think he's a nobody? It lowered man. And the stories, you'd go into a hardware store, they tell you to train. You go into a hardware store and ask for a dozen eggs, so you'd look like an idiot. So they wanted to train you that you shouldn't care what people think about you. It was a whole different approach. Man is so low, who are we? And of course, the approach of the verdict doesn't, at least in the world I live in, for sure doesn't work. I don't know if the one in Slobodka works either, but that one has a better hope. And in a certain sense, I don't know if Tosafot Yontif is exactly lunatic, but he says that's what we always have to be concerned that we are doing something wrong, and therefore reward should be the furthest thing from our mind. And he says that's like Avraham Avinu. God came to Avraham, and he said, "I'm going to go outside. See, you know, you're going to be like both the stars and like the grains of sand. You're going to have numerous. It's going to be impossible to count your descendants." And yet, after God makes one of his promises that the Zera, how much great descendants Abraham will have, Abraham says to God, you know, God, I don't have any children. Who's going to inherit me? So in a sense, that's a lack of faith. How can he say that? God has told him he's going to have children. But the Tosafot Yontif says, no, that's because of Shema Yigrom HaChet. Abraham was concerned. Maybe he sinned. God gave a promise. You say or do something, but you can lose it, perhaps. And Yaakov Avinu was the same thing. God said, I'm going to watch you. And then Yaakov Avinu says, God, if you bring me home, I'll do X, Y, and Z. What do you mean, if? God just promised. So there was this notion to always be afraid. But that's an interesting approach that... So we have basically, to summarize, one, you know, the idea that it's okay to do mitzvot to get a reward. A person who gives charity, so his tribe should live. The Gemara in Rosh Hashanah says he's a tzaddik gamur. He's a total tzaddik, even though he's giving mitzvot to get a reward. And whether we can reconcile with this, I don't even care. Maybe you can reconcile this case, that case, or they're arguing. But you have the idea that you can give it specifically. The commentaries say, yeah, you can't say if God forbid the son doesn't recover, you can't say, oh, give me, I wish I didn't give the money. In other words, you're giving the money with the hope something positive will happen, but you'll give it even if the positive does not happen. So, but that's one idea. Then you have this idea, okay, do mitzvot. You have reward, but your motive should be because you love God. But it's okay to have a reward in mind. You understand there's going to be reward. And if you don't have that approach, we're in danger of creating heretics. What do you mean? That don't get a reward. Why should I do this? And then you have this sort of more extreme approach. You should do mitzvah reward. That's bad. If you want to get a reward, even in the back of your mind, that's not ideal. So I think most of us fall into the first category. I'll give charity, a tzaddik amur, whatever. It's interesting. The latest issue of Tradition just came out a couple of weeks ago, and there was an article. Some guy wrote an article comparing advertisements for tzedakah organizations in Beit Shemesh. And he says it's fascinating. He over 10 years he looked there for Rosh Hashanah and Pesach. Why should people give charity? And he said one of the organizations you should give charity to help the poor, because it's the right thing to do. You feel good. The other organization would say, if you give charity, you'll be saved from disease. I don't know if I'm sure many of you know what's going on now. If you give 3,000 shekel to whatever this charity, it's an awful thing, and of course, I think terrible. Will guarantee you that you won't get the virus. You know, he says so. One organization, and he said it's the crowd they are catering to, and a certain crowd. The mitzvot are more because it's the right thing to do with a reward. And this other crowd is saying, give the mitzvot because you'll get a reward. What's interesting, of course, is the one that's saying it to do because you want to help people is sort of, quote unquote, the modern Orthodox organization. And the one doing it to get a reward is in the more, whatever, right-wing world, whatever you want to say. But the connection between mitzvot and reward is, of course, a long-going one, an interesting one. And ideally, we want to be properly motivated whenever we do mitzvot. To the best we can. Okay, let's move on a little bit to the next Mishnah. You know, you can spend an hour on one Mishnah, 5 hours on one Mishnah. You can spend, 20 years on Pirkei Avot. Okay, let's begin just the next Mishnah. Yossi ben Yoezer eats Sreda, but Yossi ben Yochanan eats Yerushalayim. So now we're into the period of Zugot. We're in 200 BCE to 50 BCE, around there. The first of the five pairs, they become more famous as we move ahead, right? The Torah Shel Baal Peh is only beginning. Who are Yossi ben Yoezer Ish Sreda? Yossi ben Yoezer from the town of Sreda. Yossi ben Yochanan Ish Yerushalayim. Again, the word Ish, they're both Ish. The great person, the greatest of the person. So it's very interesting. They're quoted very few times in the Talmud. The Mishnah in the end of Masechet Sota. Masechet Sota is a fascinating, a very interesting Masechet. I know the top, when I say, a Sota, people, think man accuses his wife of adultery. It's a very sad chapter. Of course, it's a very sad chapter. But the Mishnah itself, first of all, half the Masechet doesn't talk about that. It talks about Torah in translation, what can be said in Hebrew, all kinds of fascinating topics in Sota. Gemara is really a fascinating Gemara. So in the end of the Mishnah, in the ninth chapter, it talks about what happened when a whole group of rabbis died. When this one died, that was the end of this. When this one died, that was the end of that. So the Mishnah says, when Yossi ben Yoezer, and they're the first ones who they're mentioned, when Yossi ben Yoezer eats Sreda and Yossi ben Yochanan died, Batluha Eshkolot, the Eshkolot were no longer. So what's Eshkolot? So Eshkolot's a fruit, right? No, they say in rabbinic literature, then the only way the commentaries understand it, Eshkolot is Isha HaKobo, people who have everything in it. Isha Eshkolot means the person is, he knows Shas by heart, he has a PhD in nuclear physics, he's, has a business on the side. Isha HaKobo, somebody who's got everything. So the Mishnah in Sota considers him, pretty unbelievable, people. When they died, Jewish life didn't have people like that anymore. We know, and the Mishnah lists about 15 rabbis. They died, this ended, that ended. We all know that. We always say that it's true to a certain extent, but it isn't true. Every generation has to have its own leaders. The Torah always says you should go to the judge in that time. And Yiftach Bedoro Kishmuel Bedoro. Yiftach, it doesn't matter. You don't have to be as great as Moshe Rabbeinu. And a later day Sanhedrin can overrule an earlier Sanhedrin, even if they're not as great. in stature. There's a certain thing. Yes, it is true. We don't have the leadership today. We have after World War II. Rav Soloveitchik always used to make a beautiful comment. Why did our generation merit to have the state of Israel? This week, upcoming week is Yom HaTzma'ut. You know, where are we such a righteous, generation? And Rav Soloveitchik said, why did our generation get it? Because we needed it. The generation of the Vilna Gaon, Rav Chaim of Voloshin, could practice Judaism without a state of Israel. After the Holocaust, Jews could not practice Judaism. That would be the end of the Jewish people. The total understandable lack of faith, loss of faith of hundreds of thousands, millions of Jews because of the Holocaust. Without the state of Israel, that would have been the end of the Jewish people. So we needed it. Of course, he doesn't know, but it's a beautiful idea. And I think in the same way, the generation after World War II had some of the greatest leaders of the last hundreds of years. People like Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Aaron Cutler and the Lubavitcher Rebbe and people, whether you, and I don't know, the Satmar Rebbe, whatever you think of their philosophy, and we don't have to like it and we don't have to agree with it. These were people who built up Torah in unbelievable ways. And we don't have that leadership anymore. So there is something true when lose, but there's always new leaders. There are always new things. There's wonderful things going on today in the Jewish world in terms of learning of what's going on in Israel. It's unbelievable. So you have that sort of tension. Anyways, Yossi ben Yehoshua and Yossi ben Yochanan, so they're the first of the Zugot. So here, the Tosfos Yondav is another unbelievable comment. It's like, wow. So he says like this, the Zugot, the pairs, right? I mentioned that last week. One is the Nasi, one is the Abbeitin. So he says, pairs. You know what happens when you have two leaders? What happens when you have two leaders? Arguments. Machloket, right? Right. That's why. No, it's the very, very rare company. It's that you can't have two CEOs. I mean, Research in Motion, for those can Allah Bashalom, or those who live in Canada. You know, Research in Motion invented the smartphone. It's now called BlackBerry. They were they were the company in the world. They invented it in Waterloo, about an hour outside of Toronto. And they had had 70% of the world market. And Barack Obama used to use everybody had a smartphone. And then Balsillie wanted to buy an NHL hockey team. I don't know. They lost focus on the company. They made fun of Apple when Apple did all the gimmicks. They brought back Steve Jobs. Who needs all these games? And of course, BlackBerry is a struggling business. And Apple is, one of the most amazing companies in the world from a wealth creation point of view. So but they had two CEOs. Research in Motion had two CEOs. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein and Rav Amital, they're unbelievable. Two Rosh Yeshivas in Yeshivat Har Etzion. And when Rav Amital invited Rav Lichtenstein to be the Rosh Yeshiva in 1970 and 1971, he, of course, invited Rav Lichtenstein to be the Rosh Yeshiva. Rav Amital would step down. Rav Lichtenstein is greater than I am. I'm not going to be the Rosh Yeshiva. Rav Lichtenstein will be the Rosh Yeshiva. And Rav Lichtenstein agreed to take the position only on condition that Rav Amital would also be a co-Rosh Yeshiva. And they had a wonderful relationship. They were very different. Their strengths were different, which is good, I guess, and leading. But it's very hard. So the Tosfot Yontif said, the Zugot, we begin the period of Machloket in Jewish history. I think I alluded to it last week, that initially there was no Machloket. They had to went to the Kohen in the Beit HaMikdash. You had the Urim Tumim. You had prophecy. The prophets told us what to do. You didn't have any Machloket. Machloket begins, and it's true, historically, we know, the Mishnah says the first argument in Jewish history, a halachic argument, began with Yossi ben Yozer and Yossi ben Yochanan. What the Machloket was about? It's such an obscure topic. You know what they were arguing about? There's a five-generation argument. The Mishnah in Chagiga says this was a all five of the Zugot argued, one saying one, the other. Could you do smicha on an animal on Yontif? When the Beit HaMikdash stood and you brought one of the halachas is when you bring in a korban, you have to lean on the korban. We call smicha to become a rabbi. That's because Moshe put his hands on Yoshua and he leaned on him. He gave him smicha, like he put from himself onto Yoshua. So smicha, we have this notion of smicha to an animal. So the question is that we can bring certain korbanot on Yontif, but when you bring the korban, can you do smicha? So that's later, Machloket Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, but all five of the Zukot. So it's a very sort of funny machloket, and that's the first machloket in Jewish history. And Yossi ben Yoezer and Yossi ben Yochanan are arguing on this issue. Now, what's also very interesting is Yossi, Yossi ben Yoezer Isreda is mentioned really in one other place besides when they died in Sota. He's mentioned in Chagiga. It's in Masechet Chagiga that talks about the holiday, the Yom Tov, the Chag, the special Korban, the Korban Chagiga that was brought for every Yom Tov. So that's where this machloket, this argument is listed. And then after that, the Mishnah says, you know, we had different laws. We don't, you know, purity and impurity doesn't speak to us. It isn't relevant for us. But in the time of the temple, this is very important. And people wouldn't eat with each other, pure, impure. So the Mishnah says that Yossi ben Yoezer was the Chassid Shepe Kahuna. He was the most pious of all the priests. He was Chassid Shepe Kahuna. And then the Mishnah says, despite that, there's certain laws of, he couldn't be trusted, so to speak. Not that he couldn't be trusted, but he wasn't careful on certain laws. You can't assume for Kodesh. In other words, the laws of purity were different from eating Truma and for eating a sacrifice. You got to be more assured of yourself. And he says, if you're only worried about eating Truma, you can't eat a sacrifice because you didn't have in mind. So even Yossi ben Yoezer, who's the most pious of Kohanim, when he didn't specially focus on the purity for eating a sacrifice, couldn't eat a sacrifice. He was a chassid shebe kahuna. What I find fascinating is in Masechet Ediot, Masechet Ediot is probably not studied so much. I would recommend, if I can say such a thing, after brachot or something, the first thing you should learn with your kids, mishnayos, or your kavrusa, or your parents, or your brothers and sisters, is Ediot. Ediot is the first mishnah ever written, and it's got a cross section of. It's the most wide ranging mishnayot because it was the first one written. It's Ediot. It's testimonies. It's when the mishnas or the Tosefta says when the rabbis came to Yavne after the destruction of the temple, they sat. You know, Karen B'Yavne, like a vine, you know, in the, like a U-shape. They start Karen in rows, Karen B'Yavne, like, you know, grapes, the Karen, we grow them. And they started to bring, this rabbi told me this, they didn't know the future of Judaism was in doubt after the destruction of the temple. Everything's forgotten, everything's destroyed. So people are dead. This rabbi told me this rabbi told me that. And they wrote down all the testimonies from the rabbis. And it covers the entire range of Jewish law. And many of these mishnayot repeat themselves when later on they were added into the place that they are. But this mishnah does not. It says that Yossi ben Yoezer Yisreda, and we're not going to get into what, on three cases ruled that... ruled a lenient law on some of the laws of purity. On grasshoppers, he had a ruling on the laws of a lenient ruling. On the laws of purity, he had a lenient ruling. And they used to call him, he got a nickname, Yosef Shraria. Yosef, the one who allows everything. You want a heter, you want a lenient rabbi, go to Yossi ben Yoezer. Yossi Shraria, it says, Bekaru Lo, and they called him Yossi Shraria. Yossi, the one who allows everything. So I find these two mishnayot actually fascinating if you put it together. He was a chassid shepe kahuna. He was the most pious of the priest, and yet he was the one who was the most lenient of the priests. Piety doesn't mean stringency. Piety means love of God that we spoke about, that this ahavat Hashem. Piety, everything you do is for helping people to do mitzvot. But it doesn't mean you're extra strict necessarily. And those are the only two places he's mentioned in the entire, besides in Chagiga with the argument, the only places he's mentioned in the entire Talmud is this Mishnah that he was a tzaddik, he was a chassid shebe kahuna, but he was very lenient. And of course, and when he died, that was the end of people who could see everything, who had everything all combined. So I think it's a fascinating thing. We often, you know, we read these names, Joseph, you know, who are the people? Who cares who the people are? But it's always, I think, especially in Pirkei Avot, but really everything, it's always important to place the person in historical context to understand what they're saying. Okay, one other thing, I guess, okay, so, well, maybe we'll save that for next week a little bit. We can talk about... I said this is the beginning of machloket. So maybe I'll just raise the issue now a little bit. Is machloket a good thing or bad thing? And that's also just not such a simple question. I'll raise the sort of the contradiction, and then we'll, please God, we can pick up on that next week. There are two main areas, as far as I know, in the Talmud where we talk about machlokas. In other words, there are machlokas on every page. You know, when I was in Rav Schechter Shir, I learned there very quickly. Rav Schechter would ask a question, and the answer is always machloket. He would draw every answer as machloket. But then he would tell us that there was a guy in a shir last year. Then he would say, who's the machloket between? To say it's a machloket, you're always going to be right. But you have to know who argues, what they're arguing. But everything's a machloket. So there's a machloket about a machloket. There's an argument. Is machloket good? Is machloket good, or is machloket bad? So I think the more famous Gemara is the Gemara about Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, they're both about Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, but the one in Eruvin, that they argued for 3 years, and this one said, I'm right, this one said, I'm right, and then a bat kol came out, we have to talk about that, a heavenly voice came out and said, the law is like Beit Hillel, Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim chayim. Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel are both the words of the living God, Elu ve'elu, these and those, pluralism, they are both the words of the living God, but in practice, halacha kabeit hillel. I can't light Hanukkah candles 1 to 8 and 8 to 1. On the first night of Hanukkah candles, either I light one candle or 8 candles. When I make Kiddush on Friday night, either I start Borei Pri HaGafen or I start Mikdash HaShabbat. I can't start at both. So Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, you have to follow one practice, but they're both right. In other words, law has arguments, right, to make one way or another way. It's not clear cut. And one thought like this, there's a good reason why to light Hanukkah candles 1 to 8, and there's a good reason why to light Hanukkah candles 8 to 1. They both express an aspect of divine Torah. But in practice, we do one. So that's a beautiful notion. Machloket reflects different aspects of Torah. The Torah is complex, and different rabbis looked at different aspects of the Torah. That's one Gemara. There is a second Gemara in Sanhedrin, though, that sees something very different. The Gemara also talking about Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. It's actually a pretty scary Gemara. The Gemara says it used to be there were no arguments in the Jewish people. If you had a question arose, you would go to the Beit Din, and the Beit Din would decide, and and they would answer your question. Misha Rabu, Tamide Beit Hillel Beit Shammai Shaloshim Shu Rabeim Kol Tzarchan. When the students of Hillel and Shammai got very numerous, and they didn't service their teachers properly, they weren't listening 100% of the time. They went to go to the washroom for 10 minutes. They were talking to their friend. They were writing text messages in the middle of the shiur. You know, they weren't 100% focused. Misha Rabu Talmidim Shaloshim Shu Tam Rabbein Kol Tzarchan. The Rabu Machloket. We have many arguments. And Naset Torah Kishtei Torah. The Torah became like two books, two different Torahs. The Torah of Hillel, Beit Shillel, like two different religions. So that Gemara in Sanhedrin and this Gemara in Eruvin present two very different models of machloket, and we'll please God, we can pick up next week, and we can discuss should they be reconciled, how they're reconciled, what's going on here. But that's a little bit, because I said this is when machloket begins in Jewish history. But just to give a brief summary of what we discussed this morning, we started on Tignush Isocho. He's the influence of Greek culture on the Jewish people, on his name, and the notion of worshiping God out of love, doing it for a reward. How important is it to worship, to not have reward in mind? How impossible it is not to have reward in mind? What does lishma mean? Doing it for the sake of God. We can never be 100% properly motivated, but people, the more your decision affects other people, the more properly motivated a person has to be. That Avat Hashem, obviously, love of God is greater than fear or even awe of God. And that's why a positive commandment will push aside a negative commandment. But that's only when the positive commandment and that commandment relate to a mitzvah between man and God. I can never push aside a mitzvah between man and man to do a mitzvah to help, to do a mitzvah between man and God. And we discussed the Sefer Achinuch's idea, the importance of action, mitzvot are to create our character. The more we do, your motivation is less important, because what you do will help mold the type of character that you are. And then we just discussed a little bit who Yossi Ben Yehuda. You can be a chassid, You can be a pious person and a lenient person at the same time. And we ended to discuss the machloket, good or bad. And please God, we can pick up on that next week and do other things. I'm interested in any comments, questions, criticisms. You know, it's always good. I'll just very quickly, Morris asked, if you're not supposed to enjoy doing mitzvot, how do you mekayim the mitzvah gedolah liyot b'simcha? I don't know. It's a mitzvah. They mitzvah gedolah liyot b'simcha. It means does it, you should be happy. Yeah, I don't know. They probably have a different understanding of what that means. It's a different type of simcha. But right, I think the Eglei Tells approach is a beautiful approach. For historical reasons, the you can read Alan Adler's book, The Faith of the Mitnagdim. If you have the way he wrote about how Mitnagdim, the theory developed, they had a much more ascetic view of life. The Vilna Gaon was an ascetic. He didn't eat. They used to fast. If you look at many of them, with fast, we today, the Hasidim turned the fast for a yartzeit into a kiddush. So it's a whole different approach to how to do mitzvot, a little bit beyond what we're doing now. And maybe I can try to address a little bit in some future. But I want to wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom. Be healthy, be well. We have, I think, 8 or 9 shiurim planned for next week. Pretty much every day except Sunday, we have 11 in the morning and 8:30 at the evening, of course, on Friday because of the short day and because I teach a chat in 5 minutes and 10 minutes. I give my shiur at 9:30. On Fridays, but otherwise 11 and 8:30 every day. And starting next Sunday, we'll be starting also on the Sunday. So we hope to see everybody and issue your comments, ideas, and Shabbat Shalom. Be well. Thank you very much.